Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Johnette Magner, and this is a new edition of Healthline 3, where we like to focus on ways you can live a healthier life. Over the next 30 minutes, we'll be taking your calls and answering your questions. So get ready to pick up the phone and give us a call. The number is 318-219-4569. And today's featured guest is Sergio Jaramillo. Did I get that correct?
All right.
With Willis Knighton Cancer Center. And we are here to talk about esophageal cancer. Why don't we start with just the basics? What is it and where is it?
Sure, yeah. So let's talk a little bit about anatomy. So esophagus is a muscular organ that takes your food after you chew it, takes it all the way down to your stomach. It usually, the symptoms are nonspecific and we'll go over them in a little bit, and that eventually leads to a diagnosis.
Okay, so the esophagus spans from up high all the way to the stomach. So it's a fairly long.
Yeah, quite long. Just basically from around here to your neck all the way down to, right below your ribs where the stomach's at. Yeah.
Hear a lot about breast cancer, prostate cancer, or lung cancer. This is not one I hear a whole lot about. Is it common?
Yeah, it's not as common as breast or some of the other cancers. It does affect about 21,000 people per year. 80% of them are men, 20% of them are women.
Ooh, let's talk about that. Why men?
The short answer is I think that, there are some behaviors that are risk factors that are more associated with men than with women, and also men tend not to take care of themselves as well as women, which is why statistically men live less than women overall.
Unless they're married, and then they actually do live longer because the women make them go to the doctor, is that right?
You're very right about that actually. I tell that to my patients often, that being a married man is actually extends your survival.
So you said 80% men diagnosed with it. What are the risk factors aside from gender?
Yeah, so usually smoking is one, and or tobacco in general, so not just smoking, so chewing tobacco, heavy drinking. The combination of drinking and smoking is worse than just each one of them individually. Gastroesophageal reflux disease, also known as GERD, and a complication of it known as Barrett's esophagus, can be a precursor to esophageal cancer. Some people drink very hot liquids, like scalding hot, and over time that can increase your risk of esophageal cancer. The other thing that can as well is a chemical injury. So people that drink something and then they burn their esophagus, and that can eventually lead to that. Another one is obesity as well.
Of all those, which ones stand out as the biggest problem?
The first two, the drinking and the smoking and the tobacco use.
So, but it seems like smoking affects so many different organs.
Oh,
Is the esophagus even more susceptible to damage from smoking because it's all kind of right there together?
It's not necessarily more susceptible, you're right. I mean, smoking does affect, increases your risk of head and neck cancer, so pretty much anything up here. Lung cancer, esophageal cancer, kidney cancer, bladder cancer, these are all smoking-related cancers.
And alcohol. In fact, alcohol use went up during COVID, isn't that right? And it hasn't necessarily come back down.
That's right, yeah.
How does that impact, how does that lead to esophageal cancer?
In our culture, people will often have a drink, and drinking in moderation is likely okay for most people, but alcohol in itself is a toxin, and so over time that does increase the risk of esophageal cancer or head and neck cancer, for example.
Okay, so we have our phone lines up. If you'd like to give us a call, please do at 318-219-4569. And we are talking about esophageal cancer, and I want to stay on this topic of alcohol. Are certain types of alcohol worse than others? I would imagine people who do hard liquor, shots, things like that, that would be even, and if it burns your esophagus, is that an indication of it's not good?
Yeah, it's not so much like the source of it. It's, like for example, a shot of vodka is approximately equivalent to an entire beer. But it's the amount of drinking. So, you know, there are some guidelines out there that most, you know, most men should not be drinking more than 2 drinks a day, and women should be drinking like 1 drink a day. But if you look at statistics, a lot of Americans are drinking way more than that on a daily basis.
And women are drinking more now.
Yes.
So are you seeing an increase in women coming in with it?
I have not seen that, but you know, you're right that drinking is increasing in women, and that also increases the risk of other cancers in women, specifically breast cancer. So that's another one that's also increased by drinking in women.
I know individuals who actually were heavy drinkers and had their esophagus rupture.
Yeah.
Is that likely the result of having cancer and not knowing it? Do you think those were tied, or how are those related if they are?
You know, I'm thinking, you know, if they were heavy drinkers, maybe they had some liver problems, so they have cirrhosis, and so when you have cirrhosis, you have an increase in girth of the veins around the esophagus. So a lot of cirrhotics can have bleeding when they vomit, and sometimes they can vomit so much that it actually leads to esophageal tearing.
Wow. So let's talk about how you know you need to come see you.
Yeah.
What are the signs and symptoms? Because
right.
I don't honestly know that I would have any symptom that would make me think, ooh, I need to get that checked out.
Yeah, and you know, so most symptoms are nonspecific. So the majority of the cases, if you have one of these symptoms, you don't have esophageal cancer. But you know, usually, you know, heartburn-like sensation that is not going away, is persistent, perhaps worsening, difficulty swallowing. So initially, as the tumor gets bigger, solids are harder to swallow. But as the tumor gets larger, then liquids might become more difficult. So you might have some retching, you might have vomiting. As a result of the difficulty swallowing, you might be losing weight. You might notice some blood if you're vomiting. You might notice, you know, other things like that. Yeah, so those tend to be the symptoms. You know, basically I would recommend that if you have these symptoms that are not getting better with over-the-counter acid medicines, or I would talk to your primary care doctor just to make sure that there's not other studies that need to be done to rule out anything more serious.
All right. Well, we have a caller right now. Patricia, welcome to Healthline 3. What is your question, please?
Yes, I have a question. I ate some food, and when it go down in my stomach, our stomach be hurting real, real bad, especially like when I eat some sweets. My stomach hurt real, real bad.
So you're asking, you know, what might be going on. So, you know, if, you know, you were breaking up a little bit, but if I heard you correctly, you had, when you eat sweets, you might have some indigestion-like feelings. And so that can be, you know, caused by a lot of, you know, different things. So I would, you know, recommend you start with your, discussing that with your primary care doctor. And, you know, after talking to you and getting a good history, taking a look at your medical history, your risk factors, they might decide to send you to talk to a gastroenterologist to do a scope, to take a closer look at your esophagus and your stomach.
All right, do you have any other questions?
Because I was losing weight, and I have a problem with constipation also.
Are you up to date with your colonoscopies and your recommended cancer screening?
Yeah, so far I am.
Good, yeah. Well, talk more about with your primary care doctor, because you might, and especially the weight loss, you know, might be something worth looking into it, just to make sure that there's nothing else going on. But there's a large number of things that can cause these symptoms, so I'm not trying to alarm you. I'm just telling you should, you know, look into it further just to make sure that there's nothing else going on.
So it's not cancer, huh?
Well, you know, we don't know. That's why I think you should talk to your primary care doctor and go from there, and hopefully they can have you talk to a gastroenterologist and they can look into it further.
Well, okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
All right, and thank you for calling. So all these different symptoms, you start with your primary care doctor. You said that repeatedly. Is that what you recommend?
Yeah, usually, you know, most people, that's their go-to, unless you already have a gastroenterologist that you see quite often. And so it's always good to talk to them. And they know your medical history. They've known you for a long time, know your risk factors, and they can make a decision what might be the most appropriate step.
All right, well, we have another caller. Nettie, welcome to Healthline 3. What is your question for our doctor?
I have had a nagging cough for a pretty good while. I mean, like, for a couple years. And I've gone to preliminary doctors. I'm now going to my gastro doctor, and they possibly thought that I had silent acid reflux. But this cough is just, you know, it's just right from my chest up, and they've eliminated like lung cancer or whatever. So I, you know, at this point, what do we check out? Because it's like I cough all the time. And I don't know if that would have anything to do with my esophagus or not.
Do you, are you a smoker, or have you ever had a smoking history?
No.
No. So you're right that actually acid reflux is a very common cause of dry cough usually, and you know, it might be appropriate for you to see a gastroenterologist if you have not. They might go down with a camera and take a look, and just to make sure that there's nothing going on. They might also look at your stomach. They might test you for something called H. pylori, which can be a cause of worsening reflux. In addition, other things like a chest x-ray and potentially a CT of your chest, depending on your other symptoms, might be indicated. But I would start with that initially before I would go down the road of a CT scan.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you so much for calling. So go see your primary care doctor, and if the primary care doctor suspects that there might be a problem, they send that individual to you. What happens then?
So usually the first step is to take a look with a camera. So a GI doctor, a gastroenterologist, will do something called an EGD, which is when they go in with a camera. If they find something suspicious, they'll take a biopsy. So it might be a few days before we get the result. If it is cancer, it could either be a squamous cell carcinoma or an adenocarcinoma. And there's a few things that need to be done once the diagnosis is established to determine the stage and what the right treatment might be for the person.
You know, we have colonoscopies once we reach a certain age. Yeah. Because that's just one of those things you're advised to do. Are scopes the same way or not?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in the United States, we do not screen for esophageal cancer or stomach cancer. Everybody should be getting a colonoscopy at starting age 45. It's usually done every 10 years. Some people get them done sooner if you have some genetic predisposition to rectal cancer, or you have relatives that have been diagnosed at a younger age. But generally speaking, that should be, you know, when we start. For esophageal and gastric cancer, we usually do not screen. So usually our symptoms are the ones that trigger a further workup. In Japan, where there is much higher rates of stomach cancer, they actually have screening for that.
Okay, now I'm intrigued. I thought the Japanese had a better diet than we do.
They do, for sure, and mm-hmm. You know, they have way less rates of cardiovascular disease and other things that are really as a result of the bad American Western diet. But they do eat a lot of smoked fish, and the smoked fish has a lot of compounds in it that do increase the risk of stomach cancer. And so that's why you see a lot more stomach cancer in Japan.
So stay away from smoked fish.
Yeah, well, yeah, certainly, you know, in moderation, if you're gonna have some, it's okay. But, you know, don't make it a daily part of your diet.
So you talked about the two different types of cancer.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about how they're different, and you know, which one is generally more serious.
Yes, yeah, so they're both equally serious, but they're different because of how they look on the microscope. It has to do with the type of cell that is involved. It usually has to do with the location. So usually if the cancer is located at the gastroesophageal junction or at that upper part of the stomach, it tends to be more of an adenocarcinoma. Whereas mid esophagus and upper esophagus or that upper part of the lower esophagus can be more likely more of a squamous cell carcinoma.
Now, if someone comes in, you screen, you find it. Where do they go from there? And here's the other question I have. The symptoms are associated with so many other things too, do you often see people a little later than
you
wish you had?
Yeah, absolutely, because the symptoms are so nonspecific. People do tend to get to us a little bit later. And that is partly why a lot of esophageal cancer is diagnosed at later stages and not at that very, very early stage.
All right, so when you are diagnosed, what happens from there?
How do you get diagnosed? Yeah, so the way you get diagnosed is you have the scope, you have a biopsy. There's some staging that is done after the diagnosis is established. It's usually a PET scan, ideally, or a CT chest of the pelvis. In addition, if you have an esophageal tumor in the upper or mid esophagus, you might also have a bronchoscopy where when they go down and also look at your trachea, make sure that it's not invading through the trachea. These are all things that are part of staging and have prognostic significance. In addition, they also will do an endoscopic ultrasound when they go down. And that is also allows us to visualize which layers of the esophagus are invaded and involved, which gives us a stage. And once we have all of that information, then we can decide what the best treatment is for you.
Is this cancer associated with HPV?
It can be. It's rare. Usually not so much the lower esophagus. It's more of the very upper esophagus or in the neck. You can have upper esophageal tumors that are HPV positive, which is a risk factor for pretty much head and neck cancer. So tonsillar cancer, base of tongue cancer, these are all things that are HPV related.
And HPV, when it appears there in men more likely. Is that correct?
Men and women, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right, so you stage the cancer. When you find it, what stages do you typically see?
Yeah, so, you know, if you have a very early stage tumor where it's only invading that very inner layer of the esophagus, so the esophagus is like a hollowed out onion. You have an inner layer, you have a middle layer that is a muscle layer, and you have an outer layer. So usually if it's at the very, very front of that inner layer, the patient is not referred to a radiation oncologist. Usually they either have a laser ablation, they have a resection, or they have surgery. But then once you have more of a stage 2, stage 3, or a more advanced stage 1, then usually the patient is sent to a medical oncologist, a radiation oncologist, and a surgeon.
And so let's talk about radiation treatment. How long is radiation treatment?
Yeah, so the radiation is every day, Monday through Friday, for about 6 weeks, so 28 treatments. The chemotherapy is usually once a week, and the surgery is usually done after all of that.
And generally, you know, you have those cancers that people don't recover as often from, and then you have those that usually they do. How does this one rank among the likelihood of recovery?
Yeah, so the prognosis of esophageal cancer, like every cancer, has to do with the stage. And so, you know, generally speaking, we have three categories. We have localized disease, we have more regional disease, and we have metastatic disease. So localized disease is defined as it is only in the esophagus, not in your lymph nodes, not growing outside of the esophagus, invading adjacent structures. Regional disease has to do more when it's starting to break outside of the esophagus, invading nearby structures, or is in your lymph nodes. Metastatic disease is when it's elsewhere. And so the overall 5-year survival, taking into account all the stages, is about 20 to 25%. If you have localized disease, then the 5-year survival is about 50%. And then if you have regional disease is about 25%. If you have metastatic disease, it's about 6%.
That's not good.
Yeah, it's not good, and which is why it's a very deadly cancer when it's found. In
wow.
a lot of cases, yeah.
All right, so we have Gary with us now. Gary, what is your question for our doctor, please?
Yes, hello, how are y'all? My question is if you could speak to a condition called Zinker diverticulitis.
Yeah.
If you know what causes that, and is it, you know, could it cause cancer or cancer cause it? Is it any relations to, you know, will it cause cancer?
Yeah, thank you, Gary, for your question. So, you know, that is, you know, having diverticuli, which can be caused by different things. Sometimes they're secondary to some kind of esophageal injury, and some people just get them on their own. But those strictures and diverticuli can sometimes become cancerous or precancerous. And so that is why it is important to avoid some of these risk factors and make sure you're seeing somebody to keep monitoring the diverticuli.
And when you're saying diverticuli, is the term Zinker with it, is that different, or?
It's just a specific type named after somebody. A diverticuli is a narrowing in the esophagus. You know, sometimes it's caused by scarring, or sometimes it just happens on its own.
What I'm understanding is like pockets, openings, or well, not an opening, a pocket, like.
Yeah, yeah. So
esophagus.
Yeah, like an outpouching.
Yes, yes. So you're saying that it might lead to cancer, or could, or it's not.
I think, you know, what I'm saying is I think it's unlikely in your case unless you have, you know, one of those risk factors, but. It's not something that you should, you know, worry about generally, but it is something to keep in the back of your mind if you are having, do you have symptoms of reflux? Are they under control? You know, are you smoking? Are you heavily drinking? These are modifiable risk factors, and so, you know, I would recommend you live, you know, a healthy life and avoid some of these things.
And you said earlier, doing cancer screening, if you could just review on that of overall healthy, what you meant by cancer screening, what exactly is that detail?
Yeah, so by cancer screening, I was mostly primarily referring, you know, to a colonoscopy. So, you know, as we get older, you know, at age 45, everybody should be getting a colonoscopy. Colorectal cancer is on the rise, and usually it's done every 10 years, but depending on what they find and the type of polyps, they sometimes have you come back sooner, you know, there are other recommended cancer screenings. So, for example, you know, as you get older, you could consider starting to get screened for prostate cancer. So, a PSA, for example, in the case of men, a rectal exam to check the prostate. Women should be getting their mammograms starting at age 40. And of course, they should be getting their pap smears. Those are the general recommended cancer screenings for most people.
Thank you, sir.
There is no screening in the esophagus. So if you're doing okay with your Zinker's diverticulum and you're under the care of a physician and they're not recommending any further studies, that would be what I would follow.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Gary. Well, let's talk about the options available at Willis-Knighton for radiation therapy. Can you take us through the different things that you all have?
Yeah. So we have the state of Louisiana most advanced radiation facility. We have X-ray therapy, and we have proton therapy. Mm-hmm. We have all the tools necessary to deliver the most modern type of radiation at our facility.
And how are X-ray and proton different, and which is preferable?
So it depends on the situation. So X-rays is basically a massless particle that it's similar to the sun, that's energy, and it's invisible, and it goes right through you, delivers the dose in a predetermined area. a proton is actually a particle. It's a hydrogen atom. So it is accelerated closer to the speed of light in a magnet, and the particles are both X-rays and protons damage DNA, thereby killing cancer cells. So the proton is delivered to the area of interest, and over multiple courses kills the cancer.
All right, and any studies going on that you want to tell us about?
Sure, yeah. So, and I meant to answer the second part of your previous question, I just remembered. You asked which one's more preferable. So, you know, I don't think, it depends on the situation. In the case of esophageal cancer, there's some really good data that I'll go over next for proton therapy, but there are some times when proton therapy might not be the best way to treat something. It's the way I think of it is, it's like a tool in your box. Sometimes you have a certain screwdriver that is better than the other, but that doesn't mean that there's one screwdriver that is the one that you use for everything. Okay. And so there is some good data for proton esophagus. There was a phase 2 study published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, published in 2020 out of MD Anderson, and they looked at patients that they treated with a 28-day course of radiation, and half of them were treated with X-rays and the other half were treated with proton. And they found that the proton arm had significantly less toxicity and postoperative complications. You know, if you want specific numbers, the toxicity was about twice as much with X-rays, and the postoperative complications were about 8 times as much. So
wow.
Because of that, there is a larger study that is currently being done at a multi-institutional national level looking at this question. But, you know, we believe, and I believe the data does show that their proton therapy is a very promising option. There was also a meta-analysis published last year in 2023 in the Journal of American Medical Association, which also combined, you know, greater than 40 studies and did a very robust statistical analysis, and also suggested a benefit of proton therapy over traditional X-ray therapy in the case of esophageal cancer.
All right, and I believe we have another caller. Fitzgerald, I believe is the name. Would you welcome to the show. What is your question for the doctor?
First of all, I'd like to say I just tuned into your program, and it sounds very exciting to me, because I did have prostate cancer when I was 60 years old, and now I'm 81. What I want to know, I've been with my primary care doctor for about 20 years, and he never talks about screening. Should I change my primary care doctor?
Well,
be careful with that one, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I don't know your primary care doctor, so I mean, I can't speak to that. But, you know, what I would say is, you know, if I would recommend that you talk to them about your concerns. There might be a reason why they have not discussed that with you. And go from there. You know, of course, with, you know, anything, you know, we're all patients, and you know, if you're unhappy with the care that you're getting, you're certainly, and you know, you have the right to, you know, seek a second opinion and see.
All right. Do you have any other questions for our doctor? Okay. So 1 minute left. Tell people where they can find you.
Sure, yeah. So I'm at Willis Lyon Cancer Center. There are 4 other radiation oncologists there, and we have a large team of surgeons, medical oncologists. So if you're diagnosed with any sort of cancer, give us a call, and we can get you plugged in with all the appropriate people that should be involved in your care.
Okay, and what number to call?
I actually don't know it by memory, but if you look up, I have it in my wallet, actually.
Oh, okay. Well, you know what? We will just, I'm sure it's on our website.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me. This is a really interesting and informative program. And
sure.
Thank you for joining us for Healthline 3. Have a good day.